the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Bobby Summerfield.
Hi, Mike.
And over here on the left, we've got Rob Arbatier.
Hi, Mike.
Andrew and Martin and Scott are not with us today. But we've got some amazing pinch hitters today, and I'm going to start over here. We have Steve Davis. Steve,
how you doing?
And Steve's a you're a composer. And
I'm a composer and mixer, and I work with Bobby Summerfield as an assistant.
Oh, I'm sorry. And sitting in with us today, we also have April. April,
hello, Mike,
our producer.
April.
Wow, that's nice, April.
Thank you. Good.
And next to her, we have our special guest, Ollie Marlin. Ollie, welcome.
Good evening.
I just want to bring up a few things before we get going. And the first thing I wanted to bring up is before we started out, I told everybody about something that I heard, and I know they've heard it too, but I actually got to hear the raw 24 tracks of Bohemian Rhapsody.
Wow.
Ooh, top class.
And it was actually really cool because you can learn a lot by studying other people's work. And at the same time, I was really conflicted because apparently this is available on the internet. And
dodgy.
Yeah. I don't know. I just wanted to kind of open it up to you guys. What do you think about that? I mean, obviously it's a huge violation, as you said, Rob, of Queen and what they've done. But I'm really conflicted because on one hand, you have the raw 24 tracks of one of the greatest songs ever, and you really get to study and listen to see what they've done. But on the other hand, you really weren't supposed to go through these doors.
Well, it's definitely a fascinating thing to hear, and I think anybody would learn something from hearing it, and it's definitely a really cool thing to hear. But my initial reaction when I heard that it was on the internet is just, first of all, it's a matter of time before a bunch of rappers just take parts of the track and end up, you know, doing hip-hop on top of it.
What's wrong with that?
Just, you know, totally cheapening it. I mean, it went from being, the moment it went on the internet, it went from being an absolutely priceless recording that no one, you know, could have access to except the original guys and people who really owned it and created it.
Right.
It went from being a priceless thing to a nearly worthless thing because it's free. Anybody can do anything they want with it, and it just cheapens it down to zero. I mean, it's an interesting thing to hear, but I feel bad for whoever owns it and whoever leaked it onto the internet. If they get caught, it's not going to be pretty for them.
Is anybody going to be able to get? I mean, if somebody raps over the top of it, I mean, is that so bad? I mean, I'm asking the question, sort of asking myself that because they get the multi-track. I mean, they get the two-track on. Anybody rip off the two-track? Obviously, anybody rips off anything, so they could download that for free on the internet as it is.
Yeah, but what if they want to take just the piano track?
Yeah, I don't see how they could do that without having to pay royalties anyway.
Right, but
it's all
possibility
copyright
is there.
Material. It's all
but the possibility material. Is there now. People are going to do these tracks, and then later, when they get sued, they'll pay the royalties. And, you know, it's that whole rule in hip-hop of it's better to ask forgiveness than permission. Now people have all these
what
tracks.
What do you mean hip-hop? That's life in general.
Yeah, but I'm saying they get away with it more than others. I just, you know, it opens a door that just – if I owned a master of a classic song like that, I wouldn't want that door open. That's the way it hit me. I mean, it's still interesting to hear, but.
But you don't really know that Freddie Mercury would object, do you? Or that even Brian May.
Well, none of them had the chance to decide, unless my Brian May put it on the.
Brian May object. No, I think you're, I mean, the idea that people might use it to sample is not a bad thing. I mean, people sample anything and always have, you know. Nothing changed there. The fact that they got access to a multi-track.
I think the problem is that if you do it illegally, obviously,
Yeah, but the argument of people taking copyright and you know, doing things with it that's not legally their right to do is, that's just evolution of the music business, you know.
It is. It's just that now, like, there are some incredible guitar riffs and guitar tones and everything else. People can make samples out of them, you know, which will be really cool sounding, and
right,
they could
so
do cool
what?
Stuff.
I mean, the
I'm just saying the people who own it probably, unless the people who own it released it to the world, It's just someone stole it. It's just flat out theft, isn't it?
That brings up the question: How does a multi-track get out of the grasp of a record company or whoever owns the recordings? Obviously, yeah. I don't know who that was.
Someone has to leak it.
And this is a publicity stunt, which is a very good one, evidently, because people are starting to talk about it, I suppose.
Yeah, but I don't really know the background on the files, but you do know it was probably in an electronic format because of the remix that they did in 5.1.
Yeah, it was all in Nuendo, actually.
Mm. Yeah, and
was it really?
Uh huh.
They did a good use. I just don't
think necessarily that the idea that a lot of people might make tracks out of these things is it's a question of stealing. I don't think.
Wouldn't you be interested? I actually would be interested to see what creative people or mostly uncreative.
I'm always interested. Yeah,
see what they do with it.
I mean,
cool.
Let's face it. There's a load of crap that's made from sampling things. There's a load of crap that's made from people sitting around with an acoustic guitar. Who cares? There's crap made all the time, and there's really brilliant things made out of samples. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that people will use it. I think the fact that it's been released against the owner's wishes is a bad thing. Yeah.
That's the main thing that bugs me too, because it really is a theft.
If it is, though, and I mean, does anybody know? I don't know anything about it, actually, to tell the truth. I mean, I know it's out.
I mean,
there.
They might be groundbreaking and being the first band to release a classic multi-track on the web, but...
And the other thing is a lot of people do release stems, don't they, nowadays? It's done a lot. Because they want their fans to be able to... Do exactly
that's
that.
A great marketing tool.
Peter Gabriel was actually...
Yeah, loads of people do that.
But that's if the artist chooses to do it. That's a different thing.
I agree that if it was done against their will, then it's bad news. But it, as you say, it could possibly have been done intentionally.
Was there no story about where it came from? Or
Mike's been very quiet about that.
I think it actually
He must have got a copy somewhere. Where is it?
Well, the rumor is that it came from a Queen forum somewhere out there.
A Queen forum? You go to Queen forums, do you?
Wow. You really got to watch yourself tonight. Yeah, I think it came from like a Queen fan site. And I don't know. I don't know where it came from. I do know that a lot of fans were ecstatic to get it and a lot of people, make comments about it. And when you go reading about it, you can hear.
Make one hell of a karaoke track. <I tell
you. laughs> Hey, that's hilarious. On track so and so, he burps. And hey, do you hear this guy say this on this track?
Personally, I'd love to get a copy. I'd definitely like to chop it up and play around with it, wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
Just for fun? No?
Like you say, it's one of the greatest tracks I ever gave.
Absolutely. The best thing.
It's like looking into an artist's studio, isn't it? To me, it's like a museum piece.
Well, that's the thing. When you hear
it's a piece of genius,
When you hear the count off, and you hear, Freddie's voice in the count off, it's moments like that. And then you listen to the tracks raw. And then you can just really appreciate, the mix because you see what they started with and where they ended up with. And I don't know, it's a great learning tool, but I am, I'm definitely conflicted because it's like something that wasn't meant to be released. I don't know if it was or wasn't.
Had to be, well, for one thing, if it was released without the permission of the artist, which is obviously probably the case.
Obviously, probably
because
I never heard
any publicity about Queen relating or Queen releasing their masters to the public. So they would have, if they were doing it intentionally.
But they may not have told you if they wanted to.
I would have read it on some bathroom wall or something.
Some Queen site.
Some Queen site, which I didn't know there were any until tonight.
Oh, yes, you did.
we've worked on a bunch of projects years back, we remastered or remixed Woodstock from the original masters, and we had all the original master tapes, the 1-inch 8-track tapes, stacked up in the studio. And I mean, it was all the Hendrix, all the Janis Joplin, and everything was multi-tracks. And we ended up digitizing all that stuff. At the time, it was into WaveFrames. And I mean, it was hundreds of hours of material that all ended up digitized. But at the end of the process, the record company came in, and I mean, they basically scoured the whole studio to make sure that everything was locked up and was never going to be released. They took everything back and they were really, really cautious, and they had people coming and checking on the masters. I mean, it was a really intense process. And any kind of – I mean, even with Stevie's old masters, the stuff is all kept very, very securely. I mean, these artists think of it as their entire legacy. So for something like this to have gotten out, it's just – it's
crazy.
I wasn't actually sure what my reaction was when I just first heard what it was. I was just kind of shocked. I didn't even know what to make of it. Because you just don't hear stuff like that.
No, you don't. And yeah, it's definitely a...
I think if it is out there and available, and there's a lot of engineers out there that would like to hear it, they should. Because I think it... Young engineers, because...
Yeah,
for
if
old,
it's out,
old
they
fogies like
should.
Us, we listen to go, yes, multi-track. It, I mean, it's beautiful and brilliant, and I love it and respect it amazingly. But for younger people that don't really... have not had the luxury of listening to... like layered bands and how they use that multi-tracking process
and what a piano is really supposed to sound like and things like
and,
that
and comping. I mean, you it's apparent with that multi-track that of Queen's thing that
they, is it apparent?
Well, because like there's 95 voices singing on two tracks.
Yeah.
And
they're
all the same voice.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I haven't heard it. No. I'm just guessing. I'm surmising. No, so yeah, no, I mean, it's an educational thing. You have to listen to it and young people should listen to that and go, hey, you know something? These guys didn't have a multi-track digital machine. They had a 24 track at best.
Well, I'll tell you what, it won't be long before we'll get a comment from Brian. See what his view is.
Oh, definitely. That won't be long.
Yeah. Well, I might give him a call, yeah.
Yeah. He may have already. I haven't actually checked their site or anything like that.
That's
but,
the second time we've used that gag tonight.
But, I'm really kind of conflicted because, you know, on one hand, there's no doubt about it. It's a bootleg. It's going out there. I just Googled while we were talking and it talks about a bootleg that's out there. And, so.
But I agree with Bobby. If it is already out there, you know, it's too late.
Oh, yeah.
You can't unring the bell, yeah. You can't unring the bell, so learn from it, because it is one of the best multi-track recordings ever made.
And it really is, actually, it's absolutely. And younger people listen to that and go, wow, those vocals, how do they get that?
I think Steve's auto-tune.
Steve Davis sitting next to me is a young lad, and his first thing was, oh, they didn't have
Melodyne.
Yeah.
No auto-tune in the set.
And they didn't need it. But you actually listen to it, and you hear performance, and you hear hiss, and you hear really good engineering, and you hear a lot of many years of talent and skill in that recording. So it's great to learn from and go, man.
Absolutely.
The other thing that I've noticed when I listen,
maybe something good would come out of it. That's what I'm trying to say. Maybe people would be inspired to do better work instead of just slam it through.
Yeah.
Auto-tune and not sing.
Or they'll just sample it.
But, you know, the other thing that I noticed, though, is when you listen to it and you solo some of the tracks, it kind of, it makes it really approachable, because it just makes it, you hear their approach that they just, you know, they didn't come out of the gate with this gigantic sound. They kind of built it up and they had a plan and it just, I don't know, it seemed like, it was just really approachable. If you just learn technique and you have a great song and you just take your time to record it.
Well, I think it probably demonstrates the concept of composition in the best way that you could ever do that, you know.
Yeah, because it's real obvious when you hear the way the vocals are stacked that they had a plan.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing because when you hear the parts on their own, they may not make sense, but it's obvious it was all worked out in a way that it made sense on paper, and then you do it and it sounds incredible, but some of it's not the logical notes you'd go for.
I saw an interview with about Queen only a couple of months back, and the rest of the guys were talking about how Freddie Mercury, and obviously I'm just talking for what I saw, how he was pretty much he played on the piano, he wrote on the piano, and lots of times he would just know all these parts he wanted pretty much. He would just sing them all down, and people would replace him if they needed to, but he just had it down completely. He just had a
The man was a genius.
He was a brilliant
guy.
He was.
I think that this is going to actually bring some publicity back to the band for, like you said, the younger audience. Because if I asked my girlfriend what she saw, what she thought about the solo in Bohemian Rhapsody, I'm speaking in Portuguese to her. You know, she might not even know who Queen is. But me messing around the track. Well, 1912. You know, but like I said, I think it's going to bring back some publicity back to the band and again help younger people learn from recording techniques of analog tape.
I mean, I hope that happens. I actually think it's going to be more people our age just excited to hear multi-track than something we grew up with.
Yeah.
Honestly. Because that is an exciting thing. A song you've known for 30 years and all of a sudden you get to hear it split out like that.
Yeah,
that's pretty incredible.
It is lovely.
We're conflicted, mate.
I'm definitely conflicted because.
Where can we get a copy?
I am
apparently
nuts.
Anywhere.
I'll tell you what, I can't get a word in edgeways of April.
I know. I need to stop.
Go on, April, say something.
Well, I'd have to agree, actually, with you guys, but also Rob, because I would just be afraid of some artist like Sean Kingston or something coming in and trying to like mess with it and just ruin it. And they do that with a lot of oldie songs now.
The thing is, I don't think it's ruinable. You know, even if you took a soloed guitar bit out of it and sampled it and looped it and
pissed about
with
it. Have you heard Sean Kingston?
Sean Kingston is quite ghastly, but what I'm saying is that this is such a piece of genius that whatever you did to it, you're still not going to ruin what it is.
Yeah.
You
know, and I think it is great for the younger generation to hear that and appreciate it, but I would just be afraid of what could be made out of it from
especially if the band wouldn't want that done. Especially if the people who created it wouldn't want it to happen.
But now if you got like Van Gogh and you say I got a picture, a print of Van Gogh and chopped him up, chopped his ear off and stuck it on the other side. Now if I put it in Photoshop and whatever I did with it and tweakified it around and then took a picture of my dog and stuck it in there and then made a kind of cool collage and did something artsy with it, would that be... Would I be...
That'd be ridiculous.
But I mean, that's pretty much what I'm describing. Yeah. A lot of the, you know...
Well, that's my point, yeah. I mean, you're not going to ruin the original piece of art.
Yeah, everybody's going to say, well, I love that bit of Van Gogh. It's a great picture, but we've seen it.
It demonstrates the fact that audio waves are now just simply audio waves.
I agree with that. The only difference is that a bunch of the people who created this are still around walking around, and you can ask them whether they'd want it to happen or not. Van Gogh, long time ago, so it's a different... But yeah, you don't diminish the original by doing... by having Sean Kingston rap on it or whatever.
I think the point is it's not going to diminish the original. You cannot diminish Bohemian Rhapsody. It's just a great song.
They will.
And they will. And you know what? You're going to be in the supermarket and you're going to hear, you know, samples from that being used as ringtones and, you know, people are going to use other parts of it for their answering machine. So just be prepared for the onslaught of audio.
It's not like it hasn't been done in Wayne's World.
Yeah, that's true too. All right, we're going to move on to another thing that I want to talk about really quick. I don't know if you guys read the email that I sent you, but you know, one of our listeners was inquiring about how loud we listen to our music when we're mixing and recording. Really quick, let's just I wanted to find out, like, Bobby.
If you can hear me.
What kind of levels do you use at the studio? Do you tend to listen to things, you know, at 85, or do you listen to it a little softer than that?
It depends on the mood. You know, absolutely, you have to be careful. All my life, as a young kid, I was taught that to always wear earplugs when I used to do live. I used to mix in front of the house, and it used to get really loud. Sometimes you walk in front of the stack, and it would be 120 dB, which is, for people not knowing, 120 dB is very loud and can cause damage to your ears. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure you're going to talk about this, but just for people listening, and before I answer my question, not to waffle on, but loud music, 85 dB is the typical level or an average general level that people are advised to listen to. It's not very inspiring. It doesn't really jones you. It's nice when you turn up the music loud to about 110 dB, 105 dB, when you start to feel a bit more air move and it's more of a vibe. I love listening like that, and most people do with their iPods, in fact, and stuff like that, but... That volume for exposure any more than 15 minutes will cause permanent ear damage. And that's the truth. And that's a scary, scary fact.
At what, 110?
Anything above really around about 90, 90, 95 at the most, you're getting any more than 15 minutes.
I can't believe you listen to stuff that loud, though.
At 85?
No, 95.
Oh, yeah, of course. I get up to 115 sometimes in there. But when I'm actually working...
Nick.
Yeah, when I'm working, I listen at about 90, 85 to 90. Loud, yeah. My room, I tested 117 rejection outside.
Wow.
Yikes.
Wow, that is loud, though,
yeah,
by
it's
way.
Really loud. But I don't listen to it long periods of time. I listen long periods of time at 85, 90.
Well, I think everyone's going to suffer a bit of ear damage. I know I've got some top-end loss from touring, you know, but I think we're...
No, I know we all have. Well, yeah, well, touring, you know, is a whole other game, you know?
It's just deterioration of...
And dodgy monitor mixes.
Well, doing shows, yeah.
You got monitor mixes, then you got front of house guys, and depending on what venue you're at, just a splash from the venue itself can just send those levels up.
Also, it's not just about the volume. It's also about the quality of the speakers and the smoothness of the signal. Because if you're hearing a bunch of distortion... Mm-hmm. It could be 10 dB softer than a loud, clean signal, and the distortion will mess with your ears much more than the loud, clean signal will.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know
It won't actually damage your ears, though, I don't think. I think it's SPL, sound pressure level, that damages your ears. It actually makes these little villi, they're called, they rip out.
Yeah, the little hair. I think it's also to do with the harmonics of the distortion, though.
Really?
Yeah.
That's what I've always heard. What kind of levels do you listen to, Rob?
You know, we don't... I mean, if we're mixing a film, we're mixing at 85, and the dialogue's at, like, 82, 83, whatever. I mean, it's a comfortable kind of level, and if it's a film that gets loud, usually it gets loud for a little while and then it gets quiet again. But for music, we tend not to mix very loud, because most of the stuff, if we're mixing for TV, which is what a lot of our work is, no one's going to be listening back to the stuff on thunderous giant speakers.
So right.
We're mixing for lower levels. But for music, I mean, all the artists we work with tend to listen really, really loud.
Hmm.
And I like it loud. I just try not to do it for long periods of time like Bobby.
Hmm.
I mean, my room cranks.
You have to have a little – because your ears – you can't take it. You lose perspective. Once you blow your ears out, I call it. You know, you can't really hear much, and you go, oh.
And they have to recover, and you can tell
and it's
how
like,
much you have to recover. If you step away from a mix that you did – like if you leave your room cranked up and you listen for a long time, then you go away for a half hour and come back and hit play – I mean, it'll just take your head off.
Yeah.
You don't realize how much you lose.
Steve, what levels when you work, when you compose?
You know, like when I'm working with film or anything where it's orchestral music, like Bobby said, it's not very inspiring to listen to it at low levels, but I tend to turn it down more than I turn it up. I'd say probably
about...
It must
be silent eventually.
After a little while.
Yeah. Well, I guess I listen to probably about 85. You know, it's. I try very hard not to lose my hearing, and I'm pretty young, and I've played in rock bands and always worn, earplugs.
There was a study. There's lots of studies done, but I think it's called the Fletcher-Mudson curve.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes.
Very good. And basically, it's a scale. Basically, it's a slope, and it indicates. How our ears hear, the frequency response of our hearing changes as sound pressure level gets higher.
Right.
And when you get up to about 120 dB SPL, sound pressure level, that's really how you should, what you should talk about when you talk dB levels of noise. Our hearing becomes nearly flat. And when you turn the volume down of some music on speakers, you don't get Jones as much because it's not as loud. And it's partly because our ears don't appreciate low frequencies at lower volumes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a thing called the loudness button in old stereo systems they used to have, which was basically a 20 dB boost of 100 hertz and below, or maybe even higher frequency, but somewhere around there anyway.
And it always sounded so good.
And it sounded great.
You used to have mine in all the time.
Yeah, me too.
But then you used to turn the volume up and it automatically used to disenable, or you didn't need it anymore. So when you turn it down, it would kind of keep the frequency response equal. So that's why we like louder volume
That's nice to feel the music.
You feel the air
movement, don't you, the bottom end.
Yeah, see that, I don't monitor anything that loud. But even when I do
for film mostly,
that's true, and I do a lot of TV, and I'm down. You know, I can get away with 75 and 80. But even when I do music, it's just I find if you got a really good set of speakers that will hold the bass on the lower levels. You know, people judge monitors a lot of times by when they hear. You know, if they hear the bass when it's loud, well, you should be judging your monitors if you can still hear the bass when it's a little lower.
But you know what? There's a difference between the mixing process and the creating. Process.
Big time.
And when you're mixing, you know, everything's already down, you're not going to be changing the arrangement or anything. But if you're writing a song or doing an arrangement, sometimes you just need to feel it hitting you in the head.
You do. Sometimes you do. Singers, sometimes they say,
okay,
give me 58.
We're bringing out the composer snob card now, aren't we, huh?
No, the composer death card.
Yeah.
It's different.
What?
No, I understand. I do understand that. I just find when you're going up that loud, I can't imagine.
Well,
that.
What you want to do for an education, for ear old education, is the next time you track drums. Well, anyway, I often track drums, and I have these shooting muffs you put on for guys, you know, waving in the helicopters or something, ear muffs, and they're like 29 dB rejection or something. And I give the guys either iPod headphones or something, so they plug right into their ears, and then I put that these muffs over their heads so they don't have to kill themselves. But they often play to a click, and they want the click so loud that sometimes I'll put on their headphones just to hear it.
Oh, yeah.
And it would make my eyes cross. I'm going, man, do you want this loud? It's like, oh, yeah, no, it's great.
Yeah.
And it's crazy, but when the guy is thundering away, the drums are louder than that click. And he's, you know, he's hitting the snare drum, which is creating 120 dB, and he's like foot and a half away from it.
Yeah. No, you know, touring, I got my first job as a drum tech, and I toured with a heavy metal band. And let me tell you, talk about unsafe levels. I mean, I was just, he had a Texas headphone set up, which is basically two giant cabinets behind you with a sub right underneath with your butt. And you hit that thing and it would hurt you. I mean, it would hurt. And he's playing that, and it was so loud. It was unbelievable how loud that was. And sure, it was great. You know, you're going over there and you're hearing the fills and you do the toms and they sound like, you know, rockets going off.
Yeah, but there's no magic. He's now completely deaf.
Well, I know.
He has to be.
it's just really crazy. But I just want to encourage everybody.
It's an occupational hazard. Yeah. Yeah. It's like working in a coal mine.
You know, it's fun
while it lasts, though.
But Marlon, let me ask you. Obviously, now you work a lot with in-ear monitors. And you know, we've seen the whole change to go from wedges from the band all the way to in-ears. Now most bands do all in-ears, you know.
Yeah. So I think it's less damaging.
Yeah. Now you can have a little bit of element of control on your monitoring. Do you tend to, you know, listen a little softer now that you have the in-ears? You know, do you notice that?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. And it took a long time to appreciate in-ear monitors because at first they're not nice because they cut you off from the rest of the world, or they seem to.
Strange to sing with, right?
Very odd, until you get used to them.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Ollie's a great singer, by the way. I'll add that in.
Just thank you very much.
Well, the other thing...
Yeah, they take a while to get used to, but once you're used to them, they are much better because they don't hurt your ears as much. You know, and also, you're not subject to all the varieties of the room ambience, and, you know, you can be more accurate.
They clean up a lot of the wash. That's, you know. Although they still do flood the stage with side fills, though, I've noticed.
For subs.
You normally have subs for the bass. And what I normally do is have ambience mics in the room and feed some of that in, just so you get...
Give you a bit of a Jones for the crowd.
Yeah.
Just to know if they're clapping or not. Didn't like that. They're booing.
Well, you can also... The other thing, too, is it really makes the monitor guy. The monitor guy really has to be... you know, on the ball, because now he's really
has to invest in a reverb unit.
Well, really, no, I disagree. I think his job is easier now because
feedback.
You set up a mix for the drummer's mix, and the next night it's the same. There might be a minute change. But
well, you know, that's,
in the old
that's
days,
true.
You got to go spend ages getting all the EQs and the graphics of the wedges
and
the
ringing
them is the difference.
Yeah,
and,
no, you're
you
have to ring out those wedges all the time.
Although it's more of a finesse of a mix, though, definitely for monitor guys, because a lot of times, you know, when we used to travel with wedges, you kind of, you know, the monitor guy, his whole job was to not feed back. You know, it's like, just don't feed back, and pretty much anyway.
Make it as loud as possible without feedback.
That's right. Now, you know, you have to define a little bit more of the individual instruments and give everybody a little bit more tasty mix. But you're right. You don't have to worry about all those graphics and all those EQs and all the feedback. One person I, you know, really listened to his monitor mix a lot because I was good friends with his monitor mixer was Stevie. You know, Stevie had a tremendous monitor mix. Mm-hmm. He used in-ears way back before they were, you know.
Yeah, he was one of the first ever. Yeah, exactly.
Before they were ears.
No, but it was really amazing. Larry, a good friend of ours, you know, of the podcast, he was Stevie's monitor engineer, and you know, it was like mixing a live album every night, and it was...
Yeah,
it,
they were the best sounding.
I should imagine, because did he have his own console? No, he didn't.
Yeah, he had his own console.
For a while, there was a console just for Stevie's mix.
Yeah.
And an engineer just for Stevie's mix, and everybody else had their own, one engineer, and Stevie had his own.
Yeah.
Everybody else had a microphone.
But that was an incredible mix, and in-ear monitors back then were just brand new, and basically every show, someone would show up with a new design, and they were constantly taking molds of his ears, and... You know, they went through so many different versions of the technology.
And at that time, I was the keyboard tech, so I got to hear Stevie's feed. So if, you know, I heard anything going crazy, I could troubleshoot. So I was listening to Stevie's feed all night, and it was great. It was like listening to a new live album every night.
Well, it was also great because I had a microphone on the side of the stage that was inserted into that mix, and it had a little switch on it. So when I needed to say something to him, because we would talk the whole show, and I would tell him things about when the computers are ready, or, you know, if he had to make some announcements or if he's about to walk off the stage or something, you know, I would just tell him all these things. And there were parts of the show where he'd walk up to like a precipice on the stage and then jump off, and the audience didn't realize he knew where he was, and just tricks like that. I used to be able to talk to him, and then what he would do to talk back is he would just sing things sort of under his breath in the middle of other songs, and we worked out this whole sort of unheard language. And I could ask him any question, and he could answer it during any song. It could be the quietest ballad. Yeah. He'd play something and sing it and then lean back a little bit and just kind of whisper me the answer or whatever. Yeah. And we were so cued into each other.
Yeah.
It became like two-way radio.
Or head shakes, too. I remember Rob used to read the set list.
Oh, that's right.
Pastime Paradise. He'd shake his head no.
Yeah, it was like baseball catcher. You know, you tell him what you want to do, and he just says yes or no.
Okay, can I tell you a horrible story about wedges?
Sure.
A quick one. I was doing an open air festival once, and there was this band that had a large ego. So the drummer's wedges, the guy was a pain in the butt. So my buddy and I, we stuck a 10-millisecond DDL.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm serious. And we'd switch it on, and he'd go, okay, ready, one, two. The bass player would be looking at him, and then the bass player would be looking away, going, looking at, you know, the monitor guy going, what the hell's going on? And the drummer would be like throwing sticks at the bass player saying, listen to me. It was just like one chaotic. It was quite funny.
That is great.
Yeah,
that's
pretty funny. Monitor guys can have a little bit of fun.
That's funny. Well, you know, if you're out there and the best thing you can protect is your hearing, especially if you're into audio. It just doesn't get any more simpler than that. And just mind your levels. And if you go loud, just know that there's a certain amount of time that you can do that before
14 minutes. 15 minutes and any loud,
15 minutes.
You're damaging your ears permanently.
And you know what? There's no harm in just having a cheap set of earplugs that you keep in the car or keep in your pockets or whatever in case you end up at a rehearsal or something where it's just going to be ridiculously loud. It's silly to actually do permanent damage to yourself for something that's just not that important.
Yep.
Actually, exactly. When I'm cutting a band or something, I have these little removables. They're on like they're like a plastic little U sort of thing.
Yeah, I keep those things.
Sometimes you want to go in and check a mic position on a drummer, and the guy's wailing away in there, and you open the booth, and it's like, wah! So if you've got, if you don't have your earplugs in, you can't go back behind your console and expect to EQ even, set up mics, and expect to hear well because your ears have just been toasted. So,
okay, we're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more to Ollie Marlin. I'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were talking a little bit about levels and how we should be careful. And Steve actually brought up a really good point that I know we've mentioned before, but you know we can't say it enough. Why don't you tell everybody your...
During the break, I kind of mentioned that sometimes I like to listen to mixes a little lower so that I can hear what my audience would be listening to in their car or at a low level in the background as background music. Sometimes it's easier to hear your compression. It's easier to hear your EQ. And I feel like sometimes when you listen too loud, it doesn't necessarily give you the most accurate pictures.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely at the lower level. There's a truth factor that comes up, meaning this is what it really sounds like.
Well, and Bobby and I can attest to the fact, if you want to hear how your music's going to sound in a promo, with dialogue over it, just, you know, throw a towel over your speakers and turn it down to about one.
And then have a recording of somebody scratching their head and be like...
hey, we only put your music down that low because that's the way the client wants it.
Hey.
But it's true. I mean, I'll never understand why they pay all this money for music and then you go in and you're mixing it and you have the music at a good level and you can still hear everything that they're saying. And next thing you know, what's the first note? Music's too loud.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep.
Music's too loud.
Yeah.
We can still hear the music. It's too loud.
Yeah. And they never let the composer go to the mix for obvious reasons. Never.
Because I was having tears.
Yeah.
We end up punching the guy out.
Anyway, so enough on that. I wanted to talk with Ollie a little bit more. Ollie Marlin is
Hello.
A keyboard player, you know, phenomenon. He's a, He's toured as a live keyboard player. You've done music directing. You recently did all the Grammy stuff with Tina Turner, correct?
That is correct.
And Beyonce. How was that, by the way? What exactly did you do in the Grammy?
They had a duet spot. It was actually Beyonce invited Tina because she'd appeared at a show that where Tina won an award at the Kennedy Center. So as a kind of a to reciprocate, she invited her onto the Grammys. And I mean, not that she hasn't been on it plenty of times before, but I guess Tina has been an idol of Beyonce's for a long time, and it was really cool to see them meet because she was very much in awe of her, and the energy was cool between the two of them. And, you know, it's great to see when two people are separated by generations but very connected by their art.
Right.
It's kind of an interesting energy.
And were you the music director? Did you play keyboards on it, or you the pre-production?
Yeah, both. All the above.
And
so we did a pre-record on it and rehearsed and, you know.
So a pre-record, just so that people understand, you recorded the track so that they actually sang to a track on the night of the Grammys?
Yeah.
And
it sounds like a bit of a cheat,
but I knew that Marley was playing and I thought, one take.
So how did that go? What size of the band was it? Where did you record?
Capitol, top place.
Oh, LA, yeah.
Very top historic Jesus. Studio, blind in place. It's 3 minutes away from my house. I just need some more jobs down there.
And how big was the band that you recorded?
There was just one guitar player, one bass player, and one drummer, and me. And two background singers in addition.
Now, did they ever come in to hear the tracking or hear anything, or they just got the tracks when they were done and they just did it?
I had Tina come down and do a guide.
Oh, great.
So we put the background vocals after she did a guide. And then we took it in to rehearsal with her and Beyonce, and then I just changed a couple of edits and a couple of spots and then mixed it. And then we, at the show, we used stems. So at the front of house can do a different mix to the TV truck, because obviously it's going to be different. You don't want a different mix there.
Right.
So that's the way it works. It's a Pro Tools operator backstage who runs the Pro Tools for every act on the Grammy show. And
so every act is pre-recorded?
No, but every act that has a pre-record is run by this one guy. I think the way it works is about maybe 50 or 60% of it is pre-record. It'd be kind of difficult to have everything live. I mean,
sure.
You know, a show like that is pretty ambitious. So,
wow, that's kind of cool though, getting behind the scenes and so at the actual show, I don't remember if there did you was there a band up on stage or
yeah
was
we just, yeah we mimed
you mimed.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there
a really good mimer as well, by the way?
I was gonna say.
He's spot on. He's got a nice pair of gloves too.
Are all of the lead vocals live, or is there some lip syncing from different?
The lead vocals were all live.
They are.
And we recorded background vocals and then sang background vocals live as well on top of that.
So how important was your monitor mix to your miming?
The click was important. So you know when to start.
And the count off, yeah.
How is that when you're miming in front of a bunch of people? I mean, does it, you feel silly or you feel like, okay, let's just get into
really,
this?
You know, I mean, I suppose in the early days of miming, I remember feeling silly.
Right.
You know, when it was relatively new. But now it's, you know, you're so used to it that you just do it. You know?
Well, especially when you've sung it and played it yourself.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that's true.
But the audience can't tell whether it's coming out of an instrument or off a Pro Tools track. It doesn't really
they
matter.
They can't,
that,
no. Right? So you're still performing. I mean, the fact that...
Yeah, no, I understand.
You're performing in a sense that you're projecting. You know?
Well, let's talk a little bit about what you've done, Ollie. Obviously, Bobby brought Ollie in. You guys have been friends for... Ever.
Weeks.
Hours. Well, he took me for curry earlier. That was only
that's the first time I met him. Actually, I bumped into
that. Actually, where did you meet him?
The master of crampions.
It was a reality TV show by ABC, which lasted all of 5 episodes, I think. Or was it 6?
I think it was 6. But
6. That's impressive.
5 of them got erased.
Oh, that was Masters...
You Masters of Champions?
Yes, 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 yes.
Oh, you came to that? Came to
yeah,
that.
I did. Okay, now
we
remember.
We were in the house band.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I worked
for... So he was the house conductor.
I was the house conductor. And what we had to do is Dave Vanacore wanted, long story short, we had to put a band together and we had auditions and Ollie was one of the keyboard players came down. And obviously he was a really great keyboard player. That was one, but he had a nice personality and I got on well with him. He said, you know, let's give him a bash. But everybody said no, and you know, unfortunately, we had to go with him.
No. So they took him and killed the show.
Yeah, exactly. They said, "Told you the show would get cancelled."
We ended up just being a house band for the crowd, didn't we? Singing songs to them. Yeah. It was one of those shows that was it took like about 8 hours to record an episode because they were all so appalling. You know, honestly, we used to call the presenter whose name escapes me.
John, Chris,
John, somebody or other.
Chris.
Was so bad at his lines that we used to call him OT, short for overtime. He would take so long to record that we would go into overtime, and we had this little jingle that we wrote. Every time he messed up his lines, we'd do this little jingle with OT.
The Toto. What was it? Was it Toto track?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Oksana.
That was for Oksana.
So, Ollie, obviously being a keyboard player, it sounds like you do a lot. You know, TV, you do studio stuff, you do live stuff. How did you get started? What was your story?
London, playing in little bands, in pubs and things like that. I played with a bloke who used to be in a band called Public Image. And it was sort of a post-punk kind of experimental sort of
it was a good band
that we had.
Yeah.
This guy was called Jar Wobble. We had a band called the Invaders of the Heart. And we did lots of European tours and drank lots of Jack Daniels and in a van, you know, it was like small time touring. And just went from there, you know, bigger and bigger jobs. I started working with Tina Turner in 88, I think. Did 5 world tours with her over the years until she retired in 2000. And plenty of other people in between. Joe Cocker and Debbie Harry and Andrea Bocelli and Cher recently. Worked with Cher. I'm going to go back out with her to Vegas.
Right.
She's starting up in Vegas in May at Caesar's Palace.
Boy, Vegas gigs are nice, aren't they?
I don't know. I'm a little bit worried about it because I've never been to Vegas for more than like 4 days in a go. So the idea of being there for weeks is scary.
Yeah, no, I can understand that. I've only done, you know, short stops at Vegas or like when Stevie played Vegas for a week, you know, and that was kind of nice. So what's really interesting is you have this great pedigree. You've done a lot of stuff and yet you still go out and auditions and do different things. How is that? How do you prepare for like an audition for a TV show or things like that?
I don't really prepare. I just kind of... I mean, obviously, if there's some particular sort of piece of music that I've got to learn, I'll learn it, you know. But other than that, I just sort of show up. And, I mean, it's not really an awful lot of preparation, you know, for auditions. I think...
You've done it long enough, you kind of know.
I mean, although having said that, a lot of the big jobs that I've done, I haven't auditioned for, you know. I'll just get a call from people I know. It's connections, you know, rather than... It's kind of assumed that I can play, you know. And for a lot of touring jobs, it's more about your personality and whether you get on with the whole team. And, you know, it's kind of a given that you can actually do the job. It's more about your, you know, bedside manner.
And what about technology? Do you find a pressure being a keyboard player to keep up with technology? Because you
never
know.
Yeah, it's kind of annoying, I find.
Well, that's an honest answer.
No, it is, because it's just all this new gear out all the time, and it's allegedly going to revolutionize the way you think of music, which is bollocks, isn't it? Let's face it. You know, nothing's going to revolutionize the way you think of music. Mm-hmm. You know, but there are some things that come out that are really useful. There's a thing called the Receptor, which is useful, which you can put soft synths in for on the road, which is handy.
Do you use one of those?
Yeah.
That's by Muse, right? Receptor.
Yeah. And you know, but other than that, you can't beat a proper B3. You know, and I actually really enjoy just playing simple instruments because I get a bit tired of the huge amount of program time that's involved now, where you have a show that you have to program every song, and you have like a big rack of gear, and it's just so time consuming. You know, I did a Dancing with the Stars tour recently. And there's loads of medleys, millions of medleys. So you have a hell of a lot of programming to do, with loads of sounds that you've got to program. If you're going to do a good job, you go, it takes a long while, you know. And I find that just kind of a bit annoying because it takes so long.
do you do your own programming, or do you work with a key tech to help you program, or
Yeah, well, I always have a key tech, but the actual choosing sounds and editing sounds, you do yourself pretty much.
Yeah. And what's your acts of choice?
I like Motif, piano, keyboards. Use a lot of Roland stuff. I like Korg. You know, and then lots of stuff in the rack, you know.
How about samplers? You use a lot of samplers, or do you tend to...
Yeah, I use on tour, I used to use the Akai ones a lot. They kind of got a bit out. Use stuff in the 5080 for samples, and then computers, you know. I use the samplers in Logic Audio or DP, you know, and just stuff in the box. What do we call it? In the box.
Yeah. Well, a show like Dancing with the Stars on tour... Is a lot of it like run by Logic? Does, you know?
There's quite a bit in the box. Yeah, yeah.
Was it Logic or what sequence?
No,
was
we use DP on that.
Oh, okay.
A show like that's got a lot of stuff. You have, you know, you do things like you record real horn sections, put that in. Maybe an odd some tracks that are like classic old tracks. You'll actually use a piece of an original, you know, if it's a Nat King Cole, whatever it is.
Right.
Sinatra piece, you'll actually sort of use some of that in the track and play with it.
I gotcha.
And then you might just use, you know, if there's an extra keyboard part that you haven't got enough hands to play. I mean, it's the same in the Cher show. We'll have some keyboard parts in the box just because we haven't got physically enough hands to play them all, you know.
Right.
But that's the use. I mean, my attitude of that's the thing with stuff in the box. Only put it in there if you physically can't play it. You know, I don't approve of just putting stuff in there to make your life easier. Because then it gets more boring. You know, you've got to have something to play.
Yeah. That's true.
Get a cardboard cutout. Send the bus.
Well, it's amazing, though, how touring and keyboards especially has changed from, you know, back in the days where you were hoping if your Moog oscillators were staying in tune.
Absolutely,
to nowadays, you've got, you know, a Muse or a MacBook that has all your soft synths right there, and you can just, okay, gig's over, close it up and go. Let me ask you a question. If somebody was going to start out right now and they wanted to be a working, you know, keyboard player such as yourself, what kind of advice would you give them? Do they need to know the chops? Do they need to get another job?
I'll tell you what, I mean, it's a really, really hard business to make a decent living in, you know, and getting harder and harder. It's not easy, you know. I've been really lucky to have made a reasonably good living out of it for quite a long time. But I think it's a privilege. And I don't think it's something that, you know, anybody has a right or deserves necessarily to do, you know. And it's the way that the industry is going now, there's less and less demand for the skill of actually really being able to play an instrument and being able to make a living at it.
Yeah.
It's more of a commodity now, you know. And I guess the advice would be study and get really good, number one. you know, that's about all I can say. You know, get really good at it because a lot of people think they don't need to anymore because of the technology. They think that everything will do it for you, and all you got to do is just look cool, you know. So when someone comes along that really can play because they've chosen to, you know, polish their skills, then that's a kind of a rarity, you know.
And it seems to be coming back where real musicianship is mattering again.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was great that Amy Winehouse won that stuff with like real old school players and everything else.
Yeah.
It was just...
I think she's awesome, yeah. But yeah, I think you're right. I think that there is everything goes in cycles. And
right.
The technological proliferation will in turn head back to people playing real instruments. And so I think it'd be worthwhile for people starting out to really just, you know, just you got to be totally absorbed in it. You got to spend all your time when you're 15, 16, 17. That's all you got to be interested in because otherwise, you know, you're not going to get good enough.
And someone else is.
And someone else is, yeah. Precisely, yeah.
And then you have to do, from what I'm gathering, and obviously common knowledge, you have to be able to have your technology down too. You have to be able to program like a whiz too. Because if you do get the gig, if you're a great player and there's 10 other people great players, but you can actually get the patches exactly like Dancing with the Stars once or whatever, you can, you know, that's, and the more that ammunition you have, you know, it's tough. It's the more ammunition you can, more you can bring to the table.
Yeah, it seems like you have to really wear
a
lot of...
be a nice guy, you know, it's
right.
It's,
and then you've got to have a business head on as well, because you know, if you want to get paid, you've kind of got to be fairly clever, because people will try not to pay you.
No.
Really?
So, yeah, I mean, you know.
Master of Champions, perhaps? No.
Dig.
Yeah, I think the... Yeah, you have to be an all-round... you have to have a head on. You have to get a head on in a lot of ways, as you say.
You have to drink a lot of Jack Daniels.
No, that's not a good idea. I wouldn't advise that. I can't even smell this stuff now.
Yeah, just
misspent youth.
The working keyboard player today has just such a big job, you know, with technology, with synths. And the other thing too that I've noticed is a lot of the top notch keyboard players, they know a lot of different styles. I mean, they can play everything from, you know, boogie woogie to hip hop. And
I'm grateful for the fact that I had a classical training and was really into jazz when I was young. So I covered a lot of different areas, you know, and that's for me, that's great now. So if I'm composing something, you know, I already have a handle on different styles, you know, so that's handy. But as you say, the job is bigger, because most of the time as a keyboard player, you'll end up, I mean, if you're an MD, you're putting together the show as well, usually from the get-go. So you're deciding, you're recording the pre-record stuff that's going to be in the box. You're, you know, allocating parts to other musicians and making sure that they play the right parts and, you know, that kind of thing. So
do you put the band together? Do you have a hand in?
It depends on the job. Yeah. If you put the band together, or if it's an existing band, you'll, you know, work with existing players, but a lot of the time you'll put them together, yeah. So,
like, when was the last time you put a band together? I mean, you know, a couple of years ago, and how did you get the message out? Do you just put it out in the grapevine, like, hey, you know anybody, or do you actually put it in publications?
Well, it depends. And sometimes you have to go through the audition process, you know, just because that's, you know, people want to be diplomatic about it, you know, rather than you just call your buddies, you know.
Right.
Which can be good, you know, you're always finding players. You know, there's a young guy called Justin Derrico, who's a young guitarist who I had on this Tina thing on the Grammys, who plays with Pink, that's how I knew him. And he's a young guy, awesome player, you know, and people like that come along and it's really refreshing. You know, the guy's very cool, has all the styles down, gets a great sound, and he was discovered through as an audition. So it's worth doing the auditions, because sometimes those guys come along. You know?
Let me ask everybody, when you audition people, how do you let people know that there's an audition? Is it, you know, obviously it's not Craigslist, or is it Craigslist? I mean,
no,
when you're...
It's not really great. It depends. Sometimes it depends what you're doing. The thing, like the stuff I've done has been for TV,
right,
the all TV shows, and lots of times it's either somebody, maybe there's somebody at the company you're working for that has a agency that they work for that they call up, or they ask you to call up a bunch of people. I end up calling, mostly I do, I call my mates and I say, sometimes I call on my mate who's a good, great guitar player, and I say, listen, you're not right for this part, but do you know, could you suggest anybody?
I'm the only one that's any good.
No. But you know what I'm saying? You're looking for a Menko guitar player and you've got a mate who's got a couple of mates who's been studying.
Yeah, I think you definitely use
You don't
your own
hire
networks.
People, you don't hire your mates, over and above somebody else that's better for the job, really.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It really rarely happens, at least, I mean, it doesn't really happen much. But, you ask your mates. I would call up, I think you called me the other day and I called you. I mean, as gigs go around, we all call each other.
Reference each other.
Because we all know, you know, also you have a level, you know, like me ask somebody, hey, what's that sushi place like? If you know they like, cheeseburgers the same as you, they will most probably suggest that restaurants you go on the same par sort of thing.
So. You never called.
A very nice analogy.
Hey, that's very nice. I like cheeseburgers.
You've never called me, and I know a lot of people.
I know.
You're missing out. No, I'm just kidding. No, the reason why I'm asking is because if somebody wants to get in on that, you know, on that level to hear about these auditions, I'm just trying to figure out what's
a
good way.
Well, yeah, I think, like I said earlier, occasionally they do, auditions are held, you know, to the open public, and it's kind of, a lot of time it's...
There's a lot of wasted time in there.
And it's a bit like the dancing world, you know, where they... hundreds and hundreds of dancers show up for three spots. You know? Wow. It does happen to musicians, but not anywhere near as much, you know, but...
When we did that Master of Champions, in fact, it was part of my... I was part of the process, had to get auditions, the people to auditions, and they were a lot of players. I mean, bass players, I think you were there at that stage when we...
I saw two or three, yeah.
You saw two or three, right? Yeah. The quality of the guys coming, they're amazing. Like Dan, who got the gig, he was one, and there was other three guys were great too. It's amazing the quality of the players. Certainly in Los Angeles,
this town, yeah.
We are certainly so lucky because the guys come in and they're authentic at what they play.
Right.
And they do know really well five other really strong styles. I mean, not just like, I know a couple of jazz chords.
Right.
They can really play. It's just crazy.
I will say this. We, recently, I have actually been, putting together bands for some acts I'm going to be working with. And we usually just talk to friends because if you have talented friends, they usually have talented friends and everybody can usually through referrals, even if you have to whisper down the lane four or five times, you're going to find somebody to audition who's good. But the other thing we discovered is Musicians Institute and some of the other schools now have websites where you can post audition opportunities and job opportunities and things like that for the students. And in a lot of these schools, you know, if it's Berkeley or whatever, you're gonna get some amazing players. And now they have these forums where you can actually look for people and say, we're having auditions for such and such. And you'll actually find some good players that way too.
Mm.
They've made it a lot easier. It used to be you'd call your friend who was a teacher at Musicians Institute and say, okay,
stick a note up on the bulletin board.
Yeah. And this is the same
phone number.
Exactly. And this is the same basic idea, except it's on the web and you're just hitting a lot more people.
Huh. That's kind of cool.
Idea.
But I will say for the bands we've been forming though, every single player came from someone we knew or someone who knew someone we knew. The auditions were, there are some amazing people, but they weren't as good as the people that our friends believed in.
Wow. Well, that's
just the way it worked out.
You got to get into Rob's social circle if you want to have a job.
I've
been trying. He just won't let me in.
Hey,
I'll sit outside his door for hours.
I don't know too many secrets about how to get into the audition, but I'll tell you one thing that I know I've never seen actually work, and that's the tape thrown up on stage during a show, you know. Being a keyboard tech, and I've toured with a lot of different bands. I used to have to go to the stage and you'd collect all those audition
tapes.
That's amazing. And you'd collect all
really?
The...
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I remember we used to have them handed to us in parking lots, and people used to give us tapes a lot.
I wonder if that has ever worked for anybody.
I don't think so, because usually it's just a lot of laughing in the tour bus.
We've had some very, very amusing ones on tour buses. one geezer gave us his songs, and there was a song called... Girl on a Bike. it was fantastic. She used to play it all the time on the bus. How did it go? Girl on a bike, you look so fine. Something about on Saturday night, you know.
Good rhyme there. It's brilliant.
Top stuff there.
Yeah, so if you're out there and you want to throw that tape up on stage, don't.
Because we don't have cassette players anymore.
Yeah, well, nowadays it'll be CDs, but it's
jump
like,
drive.
Well, that's what MySpace is basically.
Yeah, that's true too. That's true. I'll just never forget. You know, after the show, you go back to the tour bus, and especially the monitor guy on one tour that I was with. He was just he collected them, and
he did.
He had some great tapes, and it was funny. Bless their heart, they were trying, but it's just didn't work.
Yeah, you got to try a little smarter than that.
But it's a shame that you think about it. You're a young person, and you're like, your band comes to town. I'd love to play with them. How else can you do it if you're in like a small city that doesn't have access?
Well, you know what?
At least in those days,
there are ways on the web to do it now. Though, let's say you're a keyboard player and you're looking for bands that need a keyboard player, it's not like you have to go to every music store now and put up a flyer with a little tear off paper.
Exactly.
There are ways on the web to do it kind of intelligently.
Definitely.
Well, yeah, like you said, MySpace is definitely a great place to start. Well, hey, listen, we're gonna wrap it up now, but thank you, Ollie, for joining us and
my pleasure,
and giving us some information on being a working keyboard player. And you know, it's a rare breed, you know, working musicians in general, especially when you've got tape and you've got samples and things like that. So,
well, the tape and the samples have to come from someplace. At some point.
Yeah, but pretty soon there's going to be like four keyboard players. Sorry, I'm booked.
And one of them is a sample and hole generator.
All right. Well, before we go, before we wrap up, Rob, you working on anything fun and exciting that you want to talk about or can talk about?
Nope.
Okay.
No. We are moving forward with the exciting thing that I've been talking about for the last few months, which I will have a big announcement for in the next week or two. We're getting really close, but because of the change in the music for advertising market and movie trailer music and all the dying arts that I'm a specialist in, we've decided to branch into different directions, and we're on the verge of doing something that I think is really exciting, and we will talk about it here as soon as we can.
Oh, great.
I spent all day at the lawyer's office today, actually. We're getting close.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to that when you can actually lift the gag order.
Yeah, the gag order will be off soon.
And Ollie, your next gig, you're going to be working with Sharon?
I'm writing at the moment, a couple of different writing projects, and which is pretty exciting. Then we've got Cher starting up in Vegas at Caesar's Palace, as we mentioned earlier. And that's good because it's
might have to spin out and see him, won't we?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you're welcome to come down.
Well,
I won't
definitely.
Be able to get you free tickets.
No,
though,
that's
you know.
Not that.
Maybe a T-shirt.
A wet one.
Yeah. suit you, sir.
And April, what are you up to, April?
Oh, gosh.
April shower.
Same old, same old. Just working two jobs. Yeah, that's about it.
Tell us what they are.
Well, good old bachelor's degree paying off, working at a salon.
All right. That's good.
No, doing product
Probably
inventory.
Studying.
And then I'm
salon for bachelors?
Yes, okay. Exactly.
There you go.
And then just working at a restaurant.
And Steve, thanks for joining us. What are you working on right now?
Just finished up mastering and mixing a few bands. I've been writing pretty much nonstop in my free time. I have a girlfriend, so it's difficult to squeeze in the time, but she's very understanding. And I work with Bobby pretty
I'm
much
sorry.
Every day now. It's never a dull day.
Must be very taxing for you.
We apologize.
Well, I'm getting immersed in British dialogue. So.
Yeah, go on. Give us a demonstration.
Well, I learned the phrase chines last week.
No, that's South African. That's a different one.
That's South African, yes.
Yeah.
Well, China is English.
English
old but China. It's me old China. Term of endearment. Kind
yeah.
Of. So, me old mucker.
That's what I've been working on lately.
Me old geese. Hello, me old geezer.
Well, you know, it was funny when we were hooking up Ollie to come here. Bobby forwarded me their email conversation, and I couldn't understand their email. I read the thread, and I had to email Bobby back and said,
please translate.
So is he coming?
What does this mean? What's up with this guy?
It was funny, actually.
Can you translate?
Sweet. I like that.
Right. Top glass, geese, you know.
I couldn't understand
Top geese. Yeah, because we've abbreviated
it.
It was pretty funny. Bobby, what are you working on besides English?
Yeah, exactly. You know what I've started doing? I've started digging in the dirt. I'm doing the One Life to Live thing, so doing that, which is very nice. But musically, but technically, I've started the last 5 days. I've opened a can of worms, which I never did. I said, you know, I want to get my contact patches back together again and my template up. So. I've got, five contact machines with 64 banks of 4 banks of 16, 64 instruments in each one. And I'm actually asked Steve, I'm going through each one. I'm going, adding the script to this one, changing this one. Ah, it's been torture. But I am happy to say I've finished one machine. I have 4 more to go.
Wow.
Wow.
Hey.
That's riveting.
I just upgraded to complete head. 5.
Oh, did
so
you?
I just got contact 3.
But the colors suck.
Next podcast we'll have to talk.
I'm gonna
need some help. But anyhow. Yeah.
We're still waiting for someone from Native Instruments to come on the podcast.
Oh
right?
Yeah. Well, you know, they said you
make
know,
sure you invite
a
me
and
when
a
he comes
ago.
Down.
I'm a lynch mob. I called him the other day. We called him the other day. I said, you know, there's a bug with this wallpaper doesn't stick on the colors on contact 2 on page 2 and 3 and 4.
He said, what's contact 2?
But he said, no, I'll call you straight back. This is definitely going to work. I'll call you straight back. He said, I'll work this out and call me back. Phone hasn't rung yet. So.
Wow.
Impressive.
Wow. Okay, well, we'll have to.
But they make great stuff. They do make great
stuff.
No,
they do. I mean, the Complete 5 was it's a great suite. It's has all your staples. It has all the great soft synths. And, Contact 3, though, is definitely, you know, I see some really cool things with that. So, but we'll have to talk about it later. I just finished, mixing a documentary. That was kind of fun. I've also vowed to never work 3 all-nighters in a row. We talked about the last podcast.
We talked about that on the health cast last week.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. It was ridiculous. And, but the documentary is, turned out pretty good and we're doing some final tweaks and it's kind of fun. So, this year is going to be a total different lifestyle change for me in the studio. I'm not going to take every job and then some. I'm going to be a little bit more picky and choosy because I just don't want to die in my studio.
Yeah, that's true. Good for you.
It's true because there's people, you know, I you get locked up in the studio and you just lose sense of time. And next thing you know, it's morning and you have to go to work. So it's just something you just really got to prioritize your time. All right. Well, hey, thanks everybody for joining us. And, before we go, I do know that, Paige's album is really close. Weeks away.
Wow.
As in a couple. But
good.
You didn't hear that here, okay?
and he's away because he lost a lovely cat. He has 6 yes. cats and he lost one of them the other day to cancer.
Yeah.
Little Chloe. So
yeah.
Good vibes to Chloe.
Yeah. But all right, well, hey, I want to thank everybody for listening. And if you have any questions or comments, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And we also got a MySpace page. It's myspace.com/audionowcast. All right, for myself and all the gang here, you guys take it easy, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Aphex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbatier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaolo and uses Aphex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Is this the real thing? Is this just fantasy?